The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
And now I am honored and privileged to introduce our 2018 author, Jacqueline Woodson.
Thank you. I do think of Philly as my other Brooklyn, so thanks for that, Marie, and thanks, Marie and Joe, and Philadelphia Free Library, and the committee, and everyone who has made this event possible and gotten me to this point. It's good to be here kicking off not only this one book, Philly One Book, but also my two-year reign as National Ambassador. I couldn't think of a better city to begin than here in Philly. I'm reading for a very short time, and then we're going to chat. So I'm going to read two pieces from Brown Girl Dreaming, and then a little bit from Another Brooklyn. So this is called Tobacco. And for those of you who don't know, Brown Girl Dreaming is a memoir. Summer is over, a kiss of chill in the summer air. I'm sorry. Summer is over, a kiss of chill in the southern air. We see the dim orange of my grandfather's cigarette as he makes his way down the darkening road. Hear his evening greetings and the coughing that follows them. Not enough breath left now to sing, so I sing for him in my head where only I can hear. Where will the wedding supper be? Way down yonder in a hollow tree, The old people used to say a pinch of dirt in the mouth can tell tobacco's story. What crops are ready for picking? What needs to be left to grow? What soil is rich enough for planting in the patches of land that need a year of rest? I do not know yet how sometimes the earth makes a promise it can never keep. Tobacco fields lay fallow, crops picked clean. My grandfather coughs again, and the earth waits for what and who it will get in return. So for those of you who have not read Brown Girl Dreaming, I grew up in, I was born in Ohio, and then from Ohio we moved to South Carolina. And from South Carolina we were part of the Great Migration, and we went to New York. So the Great Migration was that period where millions of African Americans and one of the biggest acts of resistance left the oppressive South for places like Philadelphia, New York, California, to have better opportunities for themselves and their families. And my mother brought us to Brooklyn. And we would go back and forth between Brooklyn and South Carolina, where my grandparents still lived. And we called my grandfather Daddy. Daddy. It is early spring when my grandmother sends for us. Warm enough to believe again that food will come from the newly thawed earth. This is the weather, my mother says. Daddy loved to garden in. We arrive not long before my grandfather is about to take his last breaths. Breathless ourselves from our first ride in an airplane. I want to tell him about it, how loud it was when the plane lifted into the sky, each of us leaning toward the window, watching New York grow small and speckled beneath us. How the meals arrived on tiny trays, some kind of fish that none of us ate. I want to tell him how the stewardess gave us wings to pin to our blouses and shirts and told Mama we were beautiful and well-behaved. But my grandfather is sleeping when we come to his bedside, opens his eyes only to smile, turns so that my grandmother can press ice cubes against his lips. She tells us He needs his rest now. That evening, he dies. On the day he is buried, my sister and I wear white dresses, the boys in white shirts and ties. We walk slowly through Nickel Town, a long parade of people who loved him, Hope, Dell, Roman, and me, leading it. This is how we bury our dead, a silent parade through the streets, showing the world our sadness, others who knew my grandfather joining in on the walk, children waving, grown-ups dabbing at their eyes. Ashes to ashes, we say at the gravesite, with each handful of dirt we drop gently onto his lowering casket. We'll see you in the by and by, we say. We'll see you in the by and by. So I wrote Brown Girl Dreaming, and then I wrote a novel. And that novel was Another Brooklyn, but Another Brooklyn is also a biography of the neighborhood I grew up in, which is Bushwick. And on top of that biography is laid this narrative that's fiction, and over that is the poetic form. So I'm going to read, the main character is August. That year, every song was telling some part of our story. We crowded around the small radio in Sylvia's room and listened. When Gigi's mother wasn't home, we went there after school, waited while Gigi used the key that hung from around her neck to unlock the door. There was no couch in the one-room kitchenette, so we sat on the floor around her clothes-and-play record player. The volume turned down low. We leaned in to listen as Al Green begged us to lay our heads upon his pillow, and Tavares asked us to please remember what they told us to forget. And Minnie Riperton and Sylvia hit notes so high and long, it felt like the world was ending. The world was ending. We had been girls wobbling around the apartment in Gigi's mother's go-go boots, and then, and then, and then. Little pieces of Brooklyn began to fall away, revealing us. We envied each other's hair, eyes, butts, and noses. We traded clothes and shared sandwiches. Some days we laughed until soda sprayed from our own noses and hiccups erupted in our chest. When boys called our names, we said, "Don't even say my name. Don't even put it in your mouth." When they said, "You ugly anyway," we knew they were lying. When they hollered conceited, we said no, convinced. We watched them dip walk away, too young to know how to respond. The four of us together weren't something they understood. They understood girls alone, folding their arms across their breast, praying for invisibility. At 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, we knew we were being watched. So we warned each other about the shoe repair on Gates Avenue, how the old man who reminded us of Geppetto made us wait on the hard wooden seat in the little booth so he could steal glances of our legs and bare feet. "Take someone with you," we said. "Don't wear dresses when you go there. He'll offer you a quarter to see your panties." When we weren't practicing walking in Gigi's mother's shoes, we were little girls in Mary Janes and lace-up sneakers. When the heels wore down or the soles flapped away from the tops, we were given a dollar and sent to Gates Avenue. "Just a little," the man said, "please." The quarter held up, gleaming between his thumb and pointer finger. As we shook our heads no, and embarrassed tears we didn't understand sprang forward. We promised her she'd be more famous than anyone was. We told her no other brown girl had her strange eyes and crazy long hair. We believed ourselves when we said, "That's what Hollywood wants," and "I can't wait to see you on television," and "You'll be more famous than Diane Carroll." "Don't trust the altar boys," Sylvia warned her, "if you're the only altar girl." When she opened her mouth to sing Nina Simone's Just Like Tom Thumb's Blues, our throats throbbed, our teeth locked together. Sylvia lived deep inside those notes, halfway hidden from all of us. "They got some hungry women there, and man, they'll make a mess out of you." "You have to be a singer," we said. "You have to." "After law," Sylvia said. We tried to hold on. We played double dutch and jacks. We chased the ice cream truck down the block, waving our change-filled fist. We frog-jumped over tree stumps, pulled each other into gushing fire hydrants, learned to dance the loose booty to Sly and the Family Stone, hustled to Van McCoy. We bought T-shirts with our names and zodiac signs on them. But still, as we slipped deeper into 12, our breasts and butts grew, our legs got long. Something about the curve of our lips and the sway of our head suggested more to strangers than we understood. And then we were heading toward 13, walking our neighborhood as if we owned it. "Don't even look at us," we said to the boys, our palms up in front of our faces. "Look away, look away, look away." We pretended to believe we could unlock arms and walk the streets alone, but we knew we were lying. There were men inside darkened hallways, around street corners, behind draped windows. We had long lost our razor blades, and none of us had ever truly stopped chewing on our nails. But still, "I and I and I and I," we chanted. "We and we and we and we." We hand song, "Down, down, baby, down by the roller coaster, sweet, sweet baby, I'ma never let you go." Because we wanted to believe we were years and years from sweet, sweet babies. We wanted to believe we would always be connected this way. Sylvia, Gigi, and Angela had moved far past my longest fingernail, all the way up my arm. Years had passed since I'd heard my mother's voice. When she showed up again, I'd introduce her to my friends. I'd say, "You were wrong, Mama. Look at us hugging. Look at us laughing. Look at how we begin and end each other." I'd say, "Can you see this, Mama? Can you?" Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here, and I'm so glad that you read that passage, because that was really that, and I think the line where you said that Brooklyn is like a stone in my throat, were really some of, I think, the most impressionable on me. So thank you so much for sharing that with us, and welcome to Philadelphia. One question I've been wanting to ask you is, have you been here before? Are you very familiar with Philadelphia?
I have. Okay, when I was a kid, when I was in high school, I had a boyfriend who lived here, so we would come here a lot.
So, you were making that trip from your other Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Okay, got it. We're going to focus, I think, in the conversation on Another Brooklyn, because there's just so much really to dive into there. Mm-hmm. But to start off with, I want to ask you, you had already written your memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming. Mm-hmm. And as you noted before you read those passages, there is kind of this biographical aspect to Another Brooklyn. So why did you, after writing this memoir, why did you need to write Another Brooklyn?
So when I was writing Brown Girl Dreaming, in one of the passages in it is called Bushwick History Lesson, which is basically a history of Bushwick, the neighborhood I grew up in, how it went from being, when we moved there in the late 60s, early 70s, it was on the edge of white flight. And it was going from being an Irish, Italian neighborhood to being Black and Latino. And so there was this shifting going on then. And in the middle of writing Brown Girl Dreaming, I was going back and forth to Bushwick a lot. My mom ended up dying, and she left us the house there. So we were going back and forth. And I remember once I was listening to Leonard Lopate, and he was interviewing someone about tequila. And he said, you know, it's like the Bushwick of tequila. And then there was this show, Girls, and they were going to Bushwick. And I was realizing that this neighborhood that I had known as one type of place was changing very quickly and being forgotten as the place that I knew it. And I thought about the way that people come in Columbus areas, right? They come in and they quote unquote discover these neighborhoods, but disregard the fact that there were people there before and that those people were thriving in those neighborhoods and those people were having these lives. So I wanted to put a history of that neighborhood as I had known it when I was a child on the page. And that was the beginning of writing Another Brooklyn. But I didn't want to write another memoir because I had just done that with Brown Girl Dreaming. So I created this narrative of the four girls. And then I had been named Poet Laureate, and I was reading a lot of poetry and writing a lot of poetry. And poetry was on the brain, so I knew I wanted to have it to have this poetic element to it, and hence the white space and the way the language is very, very intentional.
Yeah, and so can you talk a little bit about what Brooklyn was like when you were growing up for those who haven't read Another Brooklyn yet?
It was fabulous. I love Brooklyn. I mean, Brooklyn is, you know, my sorority, we say, you know, it's in my heart and my head. Yeah. And I feel like that's the case with Brooklyn. It was a place that was... it was ever-changing, but it was a very solid Black and Latino community, mm-hmm. and it was a community of strivers. I mean, a lot of the African-Americans had come through the Great Migration. A lot of the Latino people had come through from Puerto Rico or through immigration from the Dominican Republic and from Ecuador, and people were there to try to have this American dream. And so,
did it feel like a dream as you were living it?
No, it felt like reality because I was a child, and you know, and when you're a child, it just kind of is. But I knew the expectation for us was high, and I didn't know the backstory of that expectation. Right, I didn't really understand that my mother had come out of this Jim Crow South, or that people had come from positions of persecution in Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. But it felt like a place where you lived and you had friends, and there were ice cream trucks and hopscotch and double dutch and handball and basketball, and you know, you fought with your friends and you made up, and just the, it was a childhood, and it was very idyllic to me. So when I went back and started researching for writing Another Brooklyn and reading all of this stuff about how it was this ghetto neighborhood. I mean, you know, they would call it, before we were urban, right? It was ghetto or mm-hmm. inner city. And there were all these names for neighborhoods where people of color who are underserved live. So reading these stories about the gangs and the fires and all of, I was just like, but that's not my Bushwick. That's not what I knew. That stuff did exist there, but that wasn't all that was there. And I realized that so much of the history of Bushwick was written by outsiders, and that we had never really told our story from the inside out, and that was what I was keen on doing.
Yeah, and the specter of gentrification really hangs over this book, even though you never really use the word. But as August and her friends are growing up and their bodies are changing, so mm-hmm. is their neighborhood. There's that scene where, you know, the white families are getting into the car and moving mm-hmm. away, I think, to Long Island or kind of mm-hmm. wherever. How do you experience Brooklyn all these years later now that you're there with your family?
So it wasn't gentrification. During my childhood, it was white flight.
Right.
White people were flying out of places
right.
where Black bodies were coming into.
Right.
And you know, that's the truth. And I also think in terms of really deconstructing the word gentrification, that's not what goes on. I mean, it's Columbusing. It's people coming in and putting their bodies in a space that other people have to move their bodies from because those bodies are coming into mm-hmm. it. And I think that's really important. Gentrification implies that someone is making something better.
Mm.
And I don't believe that. So I live in Park Slope. And when I moved there, you know, one of the nicknames for the neighborhood was Dyke Slope because it had a huge queer population, had a lot of Caribbean people. It had a lot of Latin people. It had a lot of mom and pop stores. And now it's a neighborhood where my family, which is a mixed race family, is the only family of color on the block.
Mm.
So I've watched what can happen when a neighborhood changes in that way. And, you know, you have to go into other neighborhoods to find diverse play dates for your kids. I mean, I literally send my kids out of the neighborhood to go to school because I want them to go to school with more kids that look like them. So I think that seeing it from a different gaze as a grown-up is oft-times troubling, especially in New York City, where you worry about your friends who are artists who might not have places to live in a couple of months, or you worry about your neighborhood where at night you walk down the street and people cross when they see you because they have this idea of who you are and what you might be up to. And I think that's kind of the danger of you know, neighborhoods changing fast, one of the many dangers.
Mm-hmm. And so, of course, at the center of this world of Brooklyn in the 1970s are these four little girls who grow up in front of our eyes as we're reading the book. And you said in the author's notes at the end that you lived with these characters for several years and you didn't even really know what their fates were going to be. Can you talk about that process? Because I think for people who don't write, it might come as a surprise that, you know, even you who's creating them almost out of thin air don't really know what's going to happen to them.
Yeah, you think you do. I mean, the writers in the room know. Like, there's this point where you think you know, you think you have a plan. I mean, I think it's a lot like parenthood. Mm. You know, you have an idea for who you want your kids to become, but that's not their idea. And I think the same thing is true. Sometimes the a story knows more than you do about what it's trying to say. So you have these characters and you put them in a room and have them talking to each other. You make them say things that are part of your subconscious or unconscious. And then suddenly someone is doing something. You're like, wait, that's not what was supposed to happen with you. But the circumstances around the world you're living in and what you're thinking about is informing that character, whether or not, again, you're aware of it and or not. And so the girls continue to surprise me. I mean, everything from even August becoming an anthropologist. Mm-hmm. Like, when I figured out that she was an anthropologist and went back, and again, it's a book I rewrote like 20-something times before it became that thin little book that y'all have. But when that happened, I realized, she had always been studying death, like all her life. You know, for a long time, my mother wasn't dead yet. Mine could have been a more tragic story. From that opening line, we see that she's contemplating death in this way, and it made so much sense when her, what she ended up doing was studying the rites and rituals of death and dying.
Yeah, and kind of going back to what we were just talking about, you know, sort of the neighborhood change and the change of these girls, there kind of are a lot of types of death and loss in this book. Her mother's death looms over the book. There's the death of childhood and kind of, you know, you know, I think the title, Another Brooklyn, implies that this is a story about a Brooklyn that's no longer in existence now, so that kind of is almost like another death that hangs over the book. Is that death, that change, something to resist, to accept, or something else?
Well, you know, what does Octavia Butler say? God is change, right? And I think change is something we have to embrace because it's going to happen whether we're ready for it or not. The same with death. The title actually is, of course, playing tribute to James Baldwin's Another Country and also to Tree Girls in Brooklyn, Colm Tobin's Brooklyn. You know, here's another Brooklyn. Here's another, and also these girls are striving for yet another Brooklyn. But I think that it is about the inevitability of change and of death and dying, which is what we see in the book, but also what August comes to have to realize.
Mm-hmm. At the beginning of the book, her mother warns her not to trust other women. And that warning comes back around and haunts her later in the book. What do you want readers to take away? You know, because so that's kind of like the bookend with all these other beautiful moments of these linked arms in between. So what do you want readers to take away about female friendship from reading Another Brooklyn?
You know, it's so funny because I would not be here without my village. You know, I would not be here without my partner, but I would also really not be here without the people, the uncles, the aunties, you know, the people who are helping us raise our children, especially the women in our village. And when I would hear women say, you know, I don't have any female friends, I can't trust them, I was always scratching my head about it. Like, how do you walk through the world without your girls? Especially because as adolescents, we have these really tight, almost homoerotic, and sometimes homoerotic relationships with our girlfriends. And so the question became, what happens to that? And I always say I write because I have questions, not because I have answers. And so I, you know, that another Brooklyn was writing to that question, how could someone get to a point where they don't have their girls anymore? And so I wanted to investigate that and see how that came to be.
Yeah. It also struck me as really poignant, kind of in the midst of the Me Too movement that we are living in. And sexuality, both the pleasure, the consequences of it, especially for young women, is a really big theme in the book. In fact, one of the girls, Gigi, as I was flipping through again today, kind of I was reminded that she experiences some sort of sexual assault at the mm-hmm. age of 12 from this soldier that's hiding behind the stairwell, although it's kind of vague. We don't exactly know what happens to her, but then all of a sudden it flashes again to the scene where the girls are, you know, she's telling them her mom might not believe her.
Mm-hmm. And they're all putting razor blades in their socks.
Yeah.
Is that something, the razor blades.
I know Terry Gross already asked you this question, but I have to ask, is that something that you did?
Oh, did I put razor? I know Terry Gross is funny. No, my mother would have kicked my behind if she had found a razor blade in my sock. You know, I think that, oh my God. But Pam Grier did it, right?
Yeah,
Pam
right.
Grier. I grew up with Pam Grier movies, and she was pulling them out of her afro, and I was like, I want to be like Pam Grier. But I wasn't even allowed to have an afro, you know? So, I mean, that's the kind of shelter I was growing up in.
Did you ever get to have one?
And now.
Yeah. For those listening to the podcast.
I did. I think, you know, by the time I was around the age where my mom's like, do whatever you want with your hair, I had relaxed it within an inch of its life, and it was a mess, you know? So it wasn't until I was an adult and became natural again that I was able to get my hair to stand up, like it's standing up now.
So thinking about kind of this Me Too movement, how do you think about these characters, these four young women mm-hmm. of color coming to age in this kind of, you know, dangerous world?
You mean how do I think about the girls coming of age in 70s, in the 70s compared to what it means to come of age in the 21st century?
Right. Like, do you think Gigi would sort of have the same response?
It's a good question. You know, I think this is, I bet there's not a single person in the audience who does not have a Me Too story. I mean, that's the culture we live in. And whether we've buried it or whether we've said it out loud, it's part of the coming of age in this country, sadly. I think one great thing about speaking truth to that kind of power is that it begins to make people aware of their rights in the world. And I think that's what Gigi was doing when she was talking to her friends about it. You know, she was saying, this happened, see me. And her friends saw her and believed it and said, we will cut this person or whatever we need to do to protect you, which for her was the answer she needed at that time. You know, she had trust, she had friends, she had her circle, they had their arms linked. I mean, and the linking of the arms, of course, comes back to the civil rights movement, right? You know, there was the whole thing of overcoming was not letting that circle be unbroken, not letting that line get broken. And so these girls, I was very intentional about having them walk with their arms linked constantly or bending into each other constantly or, touching arm to arm constantly to show how connected they were against the world.
Mm-hmm. I was kind of reminded of a good friend of mine actually reading this book who, whenever we used to talk about Sex in the City, which is another, story about four women and a friendship, and she used to say, oh, it's useless to kind of compare and say, oh, I'm the Samantha, or I'm the Miranda, you know, blah, 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 because, they're all supposed to kind of embody different elements of one woman. Was that your intention with these four different characters?
No, not at all. I mean, they were all very different to me. Mm-hmm. They were all coming from very different circumstances. They all had very different dreams. And what connected them was, of course, that they were all, you know, cisgender and identified as so, and lived in the same neighborhood and really just connected to each other. But I really wrote hard to make them different.
And be very individual. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you've described this book as being about growing up girl mm-hmm. in America, and particularly about growing up as a Black girl in America. What was that experience for you? How did you define that for yourself?
I can't imagine, of course, growing up any other way. You know, I can't, and it's funny having a 15-year-old daughter now and seeing parts of myself in her in a very different way. But you know, I feel so grateful to have been born in the body I was born in during the time that I was born, and able to flex it in the way that I was able to flex it. You know, so, and my daughter's always like, oh, you are so conceited. Like, but it really is interesting because I had such a lot, you know, I grew up Jehovah's Witness and Muslim. I grew up going between New York City and South Carolina. I grew up with, you know, well-off family from Ohio and a poor family from South Carolina and back and forth between those economic differences. Like, I think that if I hadn't been born who I was, I wouldn't be writing because I wouldn't have all these stories of all this access to information that I've gotten from just being very sheltered and very exposed at the same time. So I think when I think about growing up girl in Brooklyn, when I think about growing up Black girl in Brooklyn during the 70s, you know, with Angela Davis as my mirror, with Shirley Chisholm, with Nikki Giovanni, like Gwendolyn Brooks, I can't imagine it any other way.
Did you come to realize anything about your own girlhood that maybe you didn't realize before writing this book?
Before writing Another Brooklyn, I think I was always kind of a melancholy kid, and I think August was like that, but I think it was because I was processing as a writer from a very young age. But I think what it, again, it reminded me, my childhood friends are still very close to me. And it reminded me again of why we are so close and tight and about the history that we share. And that was really about going back and researching the Bushwick of that time that made me realize how important those friendships continue to be.
Okay. Well, Jacqueline, thank you so much. And I think we're going to get some audience questions. So we're going to have, yeah, give it up.
Thank you so
much, Jacqueline.
My book club loved this book. But we all had a question about when August is an adult and she's on the bus. With
on the
Sylvie,
train.
On the train.
Uh-huh.
With Sylvie.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand how, why did she get off the train? What was that?
So when August is, so there's a scene early in the book when August, who hasn't seen one of her close friends from childhood, Sylvia, and many, many years, sees her on the subway. And then Sylvia looks up and sees August and says, you're back, and Sylvia's reading the Times, and August gets off the train, gets off the subway at the next stop. All I can say is books are meant to be reread. And, you know, one thing that Sylvia broke her heart, and it was something she could never let go of. So one thing I wanted to show in that scene with Sylvia is that Sylvia ended up okay, right? You know, she looks good, she's well cared for, she's reading the New York Times, which is sadly, you know, and happily also a symbol of someone who is engaged in the world and somewhat educated. So I'm showing that Sylvia has made it. Sylvia's okay. And when August gets off that subway, that's still a stone in her throat, basically.
Could you share the names of some authors, women and men, perhaps black and white, perhaps so-called classical and contemporary, that you have enjoyed reading and may have inspired you as well?
So some of the authors who've inspired me, starting from the way back when, maybe not so way back when, you know, of course, Whitman, you know, one of the earliest pieces I've read and understood was Leaves of Grass. Then Raymond Carver, Alice Walker, Toni Morrison, of course, Ta-Nehisi Coates, Frost, Carson McCullers. I'm trying to think, August Wilson as a playwright, but just reading his plays. Faulkner, of course, is someone who is bedrock. My list could go on and on. You know, the poets, I love Marie Howe, I love Cornelius Eady, I love Nick Flynn, I love Keats and Yeats, you know, and Auden, and of course Frost from elementary years, and Hughes, and Nikki Giovanni, and Gwendolyn Brooks, and so lots and lots of people. James Baldwin is bedrock, Audre Lorde is bedrock, The Cancer Journals is like my Bible. But if you look at, when you read my books, you can see imprinting of so many authors, because I feel like you learn to write by reading, and you have to read broadly. And, you know, I was just revisiting Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut, because it was something that I had read a long time ago, and I wanted to see if it still kind of stood up. And it does. So I do try to read broadly. Because I have a 9-year-old son, I read a lot of comic books. And because I have a 15-year-old daughter, she's now reading another book by Sherman Alexie. We read The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian together, and now she's reading a collection of his, Tonto and The Lone Ranger and Tonto Fistfight in Heaven, but also some of his poetry. So I'm really, as ambassador, trying to read a lot more of the Native writers and Indigenous people, because I feel like that's kind of where there's a gap in our U.S. history and in our understanding of the what people have given to this country that's very important.
Thank you so much, Jacqueline, for your work. I wanted to ask you, how do you find the music and the sound in your writing, particularly within the few first sentences of Another Brooklyn? We see the beautiful relationship between music and memory, especially with the coming together of the four girls, as you describe, like as a jazz improvisation, and half notes tentatively moving toward each other. So I wanted to know how you find the music or sound in your literature?
That's a good question. I think, so I never write without my headphones on. The minute I sit down to write, the headphones go on. And this has been the case for many, many years. I remember I lived on the Cape for 5 years. I had gone there as a fellow at the Fine Arts Work Center. And that's when I still had a record player. And I was living in Motherwell Studio, this old barn that had no soundproofing whatsoever. And I think I was in my Joni Mitchell, Neil Young phase. And I would just put on the music and I'd play the same album over and over. And my neighbors upstairs, and the two painters lived upstairs and a poet was downstairs, and they just wanted to kill me. But, you know, I would sit there and play the music on repeat. So depending on what the book I'm writing is, I'll listen to the music of that time. So with Another Brooklyn, I was listening to a lot of music from the 70s, and then eventually I was listening to a lot of jazz. And then with the rewrite of it, very late in the rewrite, it was all jazz all the time, because everything I write, I have to read out loud because it has to sound a certain way. But it also has to look a certain way on the page, and the music helps me get to the sound I need. It really helps with the rhythm of the writing.
What stories did you read in your childhood to make you so inspired or frightened?
So what stories did I read? I remember I read Judy Blume, and then I read, the first writer I read that was a writer of color was Virginia Hamilton, who wrote a book called Zeeley, and that was the first time I was like, I could do this. I've wanted to write since I was 7, but I didn't know any writers. I didn't know how one got a book published. I didn't know even how to tell stories. So I guess I did because I lied a lot. But I didn't know how to get those stories published. And then I read Mildred Taylor's Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry. I read a lot of Eloise Greenfield. And kind of whatever I could get my hands on that felt like it was teaching me something about writing. When I read a book that made me go, I want to do that. I remember reading Oscar Wilde's The Selfish Giant, which was one of the books that kind of made me go, and it was one of the first books that had a sad ending, but it was one of those books that made me really say, I want to write like this. I want to make other people feel this way.
So I noticed during you answering questions, you talked about your mother, but in the book, your main character has a father and a brother. Mm-hmm. So was this made purposely to make the girl feel more isolated and dependent on her girls, or was it just another thing that came while you were writing?
Well, the fathers were very intentional in Another Brooklyn. I think there is a myth that Black fathers don't take care of their families. And I really wanted to show these two fathers trying really hard to do the right thing. Sylvia's father and August's father. And they're fiercely protective of their daughters and son, you know, and in August's case of her brother also. But there's only so much protecting you can do as a parent. And that's kind of, I think, in writing Another Brooklyn at the same time that I'm raising, you know, a teenager and a 9-year-old, or at that point 7 and 13, whatever age they were when I was writing it, I think, you know, infancy to 15. But really asking my own self questions about what it means to be a parent and how much happens when your child goes out into the world and how, you know, the Sweet Honey song, actually it's Khalil, the poem, your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of lives longing for themselves. They come through you, but they're not of you. And though they are with you, they belong not to you. Khalil Gibran. And I think that's really true, that you try to hold on as parents and then you have to let go. And so I really wanted to show these two fathers trying to hold on. And of course, as a result, it does isolate August more because she lives in this house with these two guys. And then her girls become even more important to her.
All right. Jacqueline, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Yolanda Wisher to the stage. Yolanda served as the Philadelphia Poet Laureate from 2016 through 2017 and has been a champion of both poetry and education in our city. We actually launched now in our Center for Public Life, which is our cultural and civic engagement program initiative at the library. We now manage the Poet Laureate program for the City of Philadelphia, and we're really proud of that. Thank you. And so with that, Yolanda naturally has been a wonderful friend to the Free Library of Philadelphia and currently serves on the board of directors of our affiliate institution, the Rosenbach Museum and Library. Yolanda is joined tonight by members of her band, the Afro Eaters, Mark Palacio, Carol Moog, Jaleesa Mungan, and Lance Gamble. Say hey, everybody. And we're going to have them come out to the stage, and they're going to perform. And they'll be performing an original work inspired by Another Brooklyn. And so let's have Yolanda and the band, let's thank them for being a part of One Book, One Philadelphia, and let's give them a big round of applause.
How y'all doing? Thanks for sticking around. So this is an original piece, most of it. I had to sneak some Sonia Sanchez in because, you know, kind of Sonia Sanchez city, too. And we're going to just do a quick little sound check so you can see the insides of what it looks like. We were told that you might like to see that. Testing. You want to do a little something? A little louder. This is Carol Moog. She's a beast on the harmonica. You want to try a little something, give him a little something? That's Lance Gamble on the drums. And I'm going to take the bass player home with me tonight because he's mine. That's Mark Palacio. And this fine young woman to my right used to be my student long time ago, back in 10th grade English, when I was an English teacher. And now she's my backup vocalist.
She gave me an A.
Jaleesa Mungin. And I am your poet laureate emeritus, sadly. But so thrilled about our new poet laureate and how it lives here at the library. So many good things live here at the Free Library. This is called Black Girl Majesty. Yes, I know that we are atoms to my love, but I am so far away from science. The mystery of my blood will never be understood, or why my pen seems to be a cat's heat in motion. Fuck this humanity of perfection. Fuck this code of ruthlessness. I will choose to rest my foot dangling in the earth itself, a tea bag for the gods. Y'all gonna have to help us out.
Sweat me from afar, sweat me from afar, sweat me from afar, sweat me from afar. You better sweat me from afar. Sweat me from afar, sweat me from afar, sweat me from afar.
Keep your towels near, wipe your brows clear, pimp my easy style, then go update your profile.
Yes, child.
Interview my muse instead of Googling my blues. Trying to iron out my ribs
with gifts.
Obliterate my gifts
with gifs.
Sweat me from afar. Sweat me from afar. You better sweat me from afar. Sweat me from afar. You wanna sweat me from afar.
You always
sweat me from afar.
Mama say
sweat me from afar.
You wanna
sweat me from afar. This is a little rhyme that my mom taught me. Y'all better keep snapping.
I've been told when a boy meets a girl, they take a trip around the world. Yeah, I've been told when a boy meets a girl, they take a trip around the world. I've been told when a boy meets a girl, they take a trip around the world. Hey, hey, shabba-dooba, shabba-dooba, oh, shabba-dooba. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten, Hawaiian eye. Kick one, Hawaiian eye. Kick two, Hawaiian eye. Kick three, Hawaiian eye. Kick four, Hawaiian eye.
Kick five, Hawaiian
cat, cat, cat. But that, but that, you say, but that ain't love, but that ain't love. The way you look at cat scat, that be that infatuation. Can't be love, can't be satisfaction. That be that rap, rap, that sappy, do that. It ain't love if cat don't slap.
What?
It ain't love if cat a street rat.
Sure ain't.
Be that hustling cat, be that fat pockets cat, be that cat with permanent plaits. No dex. That bad cat dance with death, getting quick spats, war gash on his back. Be that cat scat with rap to snap your back and daughter, that cat too black.
Uh-huh.
That cat like the slack. Cat scat lyrics. Cat keep you fat like
yes,
that,
like that,
like that. Daddy, but mama, no flack. He be that rat-a-tat-tat on my window. He got me doing mathematics. Be that slick cat tap dancing on my bare black back. Be that slick cat tap dancing on my bare black back. You got me cat with. You got me cat with. You got me cat with permanent, permanent, permanent plats. Plats.
Mm-hmm.
And now some words from the great Sonia Sanchez. My virginity and convert it to maternity. Wait around a century or two, see just what I'll do. Take my body, give it your brand, stitch my heart on the fatherland. Wait around a decade or two and see just what I'll do. Place my dreams on any back stair. Tune my eyes to your nightmare. Wait around a century or two and see what I'll do. Suck my breath until I stutter. Listen to the words I utter. Wait around a decade or two and see just what I'll do. Daughter one Sunday morn, drape her in dresses to be torn. Wait around a decade or two and see what I'll do. Bury me early all dressed in white. Find yourself a brand new wife. Wait around a decade or two and see what you'll finally do. Wait. See what you'll finally do.
You'll see.
See what you'll finally do.
Give it up for Sonia Sanchez. We want to thank the library for inviting the Afro Eaters here to perform. And we're really thrilled that we got to share the stage with Jacqueline Woodson. Give it up for Jacqueline Woodson and Another Brooklyn. This is our last tune. Thanks for coming. Ancestors, where do they go? Mama say they leave their tracks in the snow. Papa say they trip on life to Milky Way, become nebulous in the dark void of the mind. She's in the deep, I know. Fathoms between us drift. But do you have to die to swim? Ancestors, which way they fly? Zora say they corn liquor ether. Jimmy say they bonfires of the heart, forging knives of memory out of the dark void of the mind. She's in the deep, I know. Fathoms between us drift. But do you have to die to swim? Shall we meet again? Waltz in the bubbles of the stew. Pablo say in the iridescence of fish, pulled breathless from the dark void of the mind. She's in the deep, I know. Fathoms between us drift, yeah. But do you have to die to swim? Thank you. Give it up for the Afro Eaters. Jaleesa Mungin, Mark Palacio, Lance Gamble, and Carol Vu. And we love One Book, One Philadelphia. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.